This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll visit a corn maze.
Cool fall nights and the rustling corn and the shadows. It just fits so perfect with the Halloween season.
Plus, we'll look at the growing hemp industry in our area.
And what a new law will mean for thousands of parolees in Colorado.
Part of being free in this country, in my opinion, is the ability to vote.
That's coming up.
It's Monday, October 28th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Last week, Colorado's Zero Waste and Recycling Interim Study Committee approved two draft bills that are aimed at improving recycling in our state.
Here to tell us more about those bills and the state of Colorado's recycling is Lisa Cutter, a Democratic state representative from Jefferson County and the chair of that committee. Representative Cutter, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you so much for having me.
Colorado's recycling rate has been described by some as dismal. What can you tell us about the state of recycling here?
That's exactly the word that popped into my head as you were saying that, dismal. But you know what? I look at that as that we have a lot of room for improvement. So there's lots of good work we can do. I don't think our recycling rate fits the image people have of a beautiful green state that appreciates the environment and outdoors. So I really want to fix that.
First of all, why is it important to improve Colorado's recycling rate? Why does that matter?
You know, we did a lot of field trips as part of this committee and saw so many recycling centers and landfills. And if you could see some of the pictures, it's just shocking. I mean, trash has to have somewhere to go. And it's one image that's in my mind is in Boulder, and there was they have some great recycling practices and great facilities, and Recycle Colorado and EcoCycle, and there was an image that sort of burned into my mind of the mountains. We're looking at the window and the beautiful Front Range, you know, the mountains, gorgeous day, and just mounds and mounds of trash juxtaposed against that. And it was just really a reminder of what we need to do to protect our environment and find some place for all this trash to go that's as useful as possible.
So the Zero Waste and Recycling Interim Study Committee meets between legislative sessions. The committee was allowed to advance two bills for consideration during the upcoming session, which starts in January. Last week, the committee approved two bills. Can you tell us about what was included in those?
There's a million different ways to tackle this, right? There's all kinds of one-off things that we could be doing. But because we only had two bills in the committee, I really wanted to make sure that they had the greatest impact possible and the ability to potentially impact our climate change goals that we've already put into statute with legislation from last year. So the first bill has to do with organics management, compost, basically.
Okay.
So we've created a plan to study how we can better use compost because it does. I'm really interested in soil health and how we can actually store carbon by using compost more aggressively, and especially on agriculture lands. That has the, you know, there's a lot of positive outcomes with that. We can improve soil health. We can store carbon. We can keep the waste out of the landfills where it will release methane. I mean, there's all kinds of great things about that. So we are going to create a study around that to figure out how to more successfully and effectively use compost throughout the state, create some end markets, doing a cost benefit analysis, just really digging in and figuring out how we can be more effective and encourage more use of compost, especially in agriculture and infrastructure around that. That's one bill. And the other bill, both of them have been through a lot of stakeholding process. We really wanted to bring in all the parties that are impacted by this and make sure that we're doing this in the most thought, both of these bills in the most thoughtful way possible. So the second bill is creating infrastructure just around zero waste in general. We really recognize that we need a more centralized program and coordinated leadership to make this happen because there's lots of things happening and different areas, and we need to figure out how to make it all work together and use our resources in the best way possible. So we've directed the Pollution Prevention Advisory Board, an existing entity, to include stakeholders to develop a center to really dive into these things and figure out how we need to work together to increase end markets and infrastructure in Colorado.
So what is next for these bills?
So they're basically drafted in out of committee, and they will go to, basically, as I understand, I'm a first-year legislator, but as I understand, the council will just say, yes, they met the charge. They outline a charge for us initially when we are awarded the committees. And so they'll determine if these bills fit the charge of the committee. And if so, they should go forward to the legislature. And we have sponsors in both houses on both of these bills. I'm on both of them. They'll make their way through the process like any other bill, but they just sort of, you know, go through after this initial approval process and get introduced in January.
I know that you have championed a zero waste policy, but I'm just wondering, I mean, is zero waste actually an attainable goal?
Well, that's a really good question. I think you have to aim big. I think anything's attainable. I just think it's a matter of the time and the investment you're willing to put in. What I've learned is that things often take longer than you would hope, but that to create lasting change, you sort of have to approach it in a way that you draw the right people in and bring people on board and do it really thoughtfully with some of these committees and studies that we're doing. You know, I think that's the way to get it done. But I do think we can get to zero waste, but I think it's going to be a long process, and it's a worthy goal. Right? It's something worth shooting for sure.
Representative Lisa Cutter is the chair of the Zero Waste and Recycling Interim Study Committee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
Congressional Democrats are demanding the Interior Department produce an overdue report on plans to manage wild horses roaming federal lands in the West. The move comes after the Bureau of Land Management estimated it will take $5 billion and 15 years to get overpopulated herds under control. Colorado Representative Joe Neguse and six other Democrats say an update to the department promised by July is 3 months late, and they need it to chart the horse's future. They say it's clear the current approach is working.
Denver could be the latest city to charge shoppers if they fail to bring their own bags. City Council documents indicate people would pay at least 10 cents for every paper or plastic bag they need. 6 cents of the fee would go to the city and the other 4 cents to retailers for related costs like education or providing reusable bags. The measure is expected to be presented to the City Council in coming weeks. It mirrors one passed by Boulder in 2013 that initially reduced plastic bag use by 70% and has over the years generated roughly $1 million for the city's bag reduction program.
The Aurora City Council could take up a measure that would place limits on protesters in residential areas. Protesters would face fines of more than $2,600 if convicted for blocking sidewalks or streets, disobeying police, or picketing in a neighborhood after sundown. The proposal comes a month after protesters gathered outside the house of the warden for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Center in Aurora. Activist groups say the proposal aims to restrict their freedom of speech.
Recent snow has been good news for the ski and snowboard industry in Colorado. Arapaho Basin, Loveland, and Keystone are already open, although terrain is extremely limited. Eldora plans to open 2 weeks early on November 15th, and Wolf Creek announced it will open on Halloween. More snow is expected in the next couple of days.
Almost 4 million Coloradans are registered to vote. And a new law this year extends this constitutional right to another group of residents, people on parole. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel has more on efforts underway to register parolees ahead of Election Day.
After 2 decades in prison, Brad Simpson became a free man on September 30th. The 39-year-old has never paid rent, had an email account, or registered to vote until now.
If I don't vote, I don't have a chance to complain. I don't have a chance to voice my opinion. I don't have a chance to make the decision of whether or not I wanted this to happen or not.
Simpson is typing his name into an online voter registration form at Second Chance Center, a community reentry site in Aurora. Justin Cooper is helping him with the questions.
Do you have your ID on you?
I do have an ID in my wallet.
Excellent, my friend.
Cooper is deputy director of the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. The nonprofit began registering people in June, just days after Governor Jared Polis signed a bill restoring voting rights to more than 9,000 parolees.
People need to be able to participate in our democracy. and fully engage in that democracy and have access and opportunity to do so. And we believe that that's what House Bill 1266 was able to do.
There's no legitimate purpose in the criminal justice system for denying people who are living in the community the right to vote.
Sean Morales Doyle is senior counsel in the Voting Rights and Elections Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Criminal disenfranchisement laws, he says, date back to the post-Civil War era and attempts to dodge the 15th Amendment, which allowed black men to vote.
I think the question of why now is in large part a sort of relic of that history, rather than some policy decision that people are making in 2019 that this is the right thing to do.
But there's still a patchwork of state rules when it comes to voting rights for felons. People in Maine and Vermont never lose the right, even while incarcerated, while those in Iowa and Kentucky do for good. Colorado is now the 16th state to restore voting rights to parolees. Before, they had to wait until parole was over. And so far, more than 200 parolees have registered at Second Chance Center. It's a pretty good start, according to Center Executive Director Hassan Latif.
And we set a goal for ourselves as an agency to register 2,000 people to vote between now and in 2020's election.
Incarcerated himself, Latif was on parole in 2008 when he attended the nomination of then-Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama at Mile High Stadium in Denver. But he was literally stuck on the sidelines.
And I really felt deprived knowing that I was on parole and that I would not be able to participate.
But Latif was also inspired. 4 years later, he got off parole and registered to vote. Latif also founded Second Chance Center to help newly released individuals transition back into their communities.
So I think it's very important when you're talking about people feeling empowered in their own lives, that's something people can claim by claiming their right to vote and utilizing that vote. And we try to emphasize that to our clients here.
Adams County, State of Colorado, zip code 80010.
Okay, so now you're going to scroll down.
Brad Simpson is almost done filling out his form.
So submit.
And just like that, Simpson is registered to vote and says he plans to do so in next month's election.
I gave up the right to have my freedom for the crime I committed. Now I have my freedom back. Part of being free in this country, in my opinion, is the ability to vote.
Stephanie Daniel, KUNC Aurora.
Election day is Tuesday, November 5th. Mail ballots must be received by the county clerk by 7 p.m. on election day. So even if your ballot is postmarked by then, it won't count unless it's in the county clerk's office. The Secretary of State recommends that you not mail in ballots after today. If you've waited too long, you can always drop off ballots at designated drop-off sites.
And there are only two statewide questions on this year's ballot. You can learn about both of them at KUNC.org.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
In 2018, the federal farm bill changed the classification of hemp from a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act to just a normal agricultural product. Since then, the hemp market in Colorado has grown. Over 80,000 acres of hemp have been planted in our state in the past year, even in cities like Greeley that don't allow marijuana sales.
Here to tell us more about what is going on is Dan England. He's a freelance writer who wrote about hemp recently for the Colorado Sun. Dan, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you for having me.
First, tell our listeners, really, what is the difference between hemp and marijuana?
There is a lot of confusion about this because if you drove by a hemp field, it would look like something that maybe Cheech and Chong were growing back in the 70s. It looks like a pot farm, and it even smells like it. But what hemp is essentially, it's an agricultural product that uses the marijuana plant for products such as clothing. But the big thing is it's used in a product called CBD, which has been shown to maybe have some painkiller effects. And so the difference really is that, you know, hemp is an agricultural product and marijuana is, you know, what you might use to get stoned.
Let's switch over to Greeley now. What's going on there? How is this hemp market growing?
One of the reasons I wrote this story is because when pot was legalized, Greeley was adamant about not allowing that in its city limits. And that is allowed. Cities do have the power to say, we don't want it here, even if voters did approve it. And so they passed that almost right away. And they really left it to their neighbors in Garden City, which is this tiny little town. We call it the Las Vegas of Northern Colorado because it's sort of like anything goes there. So, you know, Greeley missed out, and they were happy to miss out. They just didn't want it in their borders. And then when the Farm Bill made hemp an agricultural product, the city's brand new economic director said, we're going to hop on this. And so they have pushed hemp about as hard as you can push a product, because they see a huge industry just starting to emerge here and they want to be a part of it. I mean, that's what any good economic director does. Since that's happened, they have formed a meetup group. The last meetup group attracted, I think, 50 people involved in the industry somehow. And that's not only the big news, but there is a new facility that's being built in far West Greeley that will produce its own CBD. This seems like an incredibly change of attitude. A city that was pretty conservative, always been conservative, and so conservative, they just didn't want what was going to be a high taxable money-making product in their borders from that, just because it's pot, you know. And now all of a sudden, because it's not pot, it's hemp, even though it comes from the pot plant, we're going to really go for it, embrace it, and try to be one of the leaders in the state on this.
I'm curious if you can describe for us some of the challenges that people face when they grow hemp.
Not only grow hemp, but produce CBD. It's an emerging industry. And I think with a lot of industries, there seems to be like a set supply chain and a way that you are able to produce the product, process the product, and then sell the product. And there's really no streamlined way to do that right now. And so growing the product is hard because you have to find pure seeds to grow hemp, because if there's any THC in these seeds or in the crop, you have to trash the whole crop. It's an incredible waste of money to do that. And so, but like with any agricultural product, they can get tainted. You know, if seeds mix, then the THC winds up in the crop, so it ruins it. So growing it is difficult, and finding pure seeds to it and the supply of those seeds is hard. And then processing it is difficult. There aren't many facilities right now that will process the CBD for you. And then you have to find a buyer for the CBD. It's hard to find, you know, a place that'll buy it mainstream, like buy it wholesale from you and then, you know, send it to places. And so there are a lot of challenges with it, although, you know, just like tech startups and things like that, there's also a lot of money to be made because it's an emerging industry. And so sometimes you just have to put up with the problems that come from an emerging industry.
Dan England is a freelance writer. You can find a link to his reporting on hemp in Greeley for the Colorado Sun on our website, KUNC.org. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Today, we're going to bring you two conversations about a fall time staple, corn mazes. We wanted to answer a seemingly simple question: how are corn mazes built? We have to talk with the owner of a company called The Maze, with an I. They're corn maze designers based in Spanish Fork, Utah. Brett Herbst is the owner of The Maze. Brett, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Glad to be here.
So let's just talk about the process of designing a corn maze. Can you walk us through it?
We get all the coordinates and the size of the field, you know, exact shape, and then we plot that on our computer, and then we get what design ideas that they're wanting, such as what theme they want, and then we'll start plotting all of that into the computer and come up with a layout. And once we get that layout, we'll send them just a rough draft of the layout, and then from that point, we just kind of go back and forth and finalize the layout, and then we start to, you know, what we call maze-ify, where we turn this themed layout into an actual navigable maze where people can, you know, not just hit a dead end and there's no way out, but make it so that, you know, it's challenging and, you know, navigates them through the majority part of the maze and, you know, and then eventually find the exit.
Do you ever design mazes to be built out of something other than corn?
We've done a few, you know, hay bale mazes or a few little hedge mazes, but mostly, I mean, 99.9% of what we do is corn mazes. You know, corn really does give it this whole other dimension of difficulty and romance and challenge. And really, it fits perfect with the fall season, you know, the cool fall nights and the rustling corn and the shadows. I mean, it just fits so perfect with the Halloween season.
What advice do you have for people going out into corn mazes? I would love to have a tip or two on how to solve a maze.
I'd say the number one thing, don't overthink it. Don't second guess yourself. Don't play follow the leader. Follow your instincts and really just have fun. I mean, all these mazes, I mean, they're not designed to lose you forever and you're going to have to eat corn for weeks at a time.
At least you won't starve.
You know, that's exactly right. But I mean, there's always a way out, and so just enjoy the challenge while you're in there.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to turn to someone here in our state who has decades of experience with corn mazes. Glenn Fritzler is the owner of Fritzler Farm Park in LaSalle, just outside of Greeley. Every autumn, hundreds of visitors show up to play zombie paintball, shoot pumpkins out of cannons, and, of course, run from chainsaw-wielding zombies as they make their way through the giant haunted corn maze known as Scream Acres. I sat down with Fritzler at the beer garden on his farm earlier this month. He began by telling us how he goes about constructing a corn maze.
It's just immediately when you're done with a season, you start thinking about the next season, about the design, what's popular, what's going on in the world, or at least Colorado for sure. It doesn't necessarily be the world, but so then we start looking at next year's design. We go to conferences to figure out what's other corn mazes are doing that's new and exciting.
Okay, and so then you have the design. When do you actually start to cut it?
In late winter, early spring. By that time, we hopefully have settled on a design, and then we email back and forth with the maze designer. They take our vision and turn it into a corn maze. And then once that's completed, we'll plant the corn maze generally in late May and then cut the design out from ground maps in early June.
What is your favorite part about doing this every fall?
There's two things. Our daytime and our nighttime are completely different. So our daytime is families and young with the children, and I love seeing the excitement of the kids, listening to them scream on the barrel train ride. They put their hands up and scream like they're on a roller coaster at Elitch's. And then at nighttime, my favorite thing is to see grown men drop to their knees begging you to stop or sacrificing their girlfriend or their wife. Here, take her, and they take off running. And so there's lots of great things. It's very, very rewarding what we do.
I would like to know what you think is the magical element of corn mazes, because it, you know, there is just something about them that's so appealing to people.
It seems to be very appealing and growing. You know, at nighttime, it's the perfect environment to scare people. The rustling of the corn, and it just has that perfect atmosphere. And in the daytime, you know, watching the families go in there and the kids take off and try to lead their parents through, and No, come this way. No, let's go that way. And it's a lot of fun and very rewarding.
You really work out some family dynamics, I think.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, you definitely find out who the leaders are.
Glenn Fritzler is the owner of Fritzler Farm Park based in LaSalle. You can visit the corn maze there through November 2nd.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll continue our week of special Halloween coverage with a conversation about what trends we're seeing in Halloween costumes this year. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.